Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. After correcting ourselves vis-a-vis the Tsarnaev trial, we have to correct the caller before we get started. The women's Final Four is not in Indiana, even though we wish it were.
Oh, too bad.
It's in Tampa, Florida. So thanks for that correction to our colleagues here. So do cultural changes demand the right spokesperson, or is having someone willing to speak up enough? That's one of the questions being debated in the case of Ellen Pao. Pao took on her former employer, one of Silicon Valley's leading venture capital firms, for gender discrimination. Her testimony did not, snap, crackle, and pop with sexual profanities. Her testimony didn't even take down her target. She lost her case late last week, but did her testimony score points for exposing Silicon Valley as an all-boys club? Here with us in Studio 3 for her take on what Ellen Pao has achieved is Harvard historian Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey, Nancy.
Hey there.
So, Nancy, before we went on the air, you said that, or I'm paraphrasing, that you thought even though the case technically was lost, that this was a big win for women in the Silicon Valley. Why do you think so?
I think just a win for another, if you will, glass ceiling, getting some, having some serious cracks in it here. Silicon Valley has, for all its trumpeting of its own iconoclasm and its, non-hierarchical nature, been very much an old boys club in terms of how many women are employed, not only in high-tech firms. Right. The most recent set of information we have about it says that in Silicon Valley, less than 20% of engineers in lots of firms are women. And we have some firm evidence that's even lower than that. But particularly in the very wealth creating companies called venture capital firms or private equity firms that actually do the initial funding for these high tech firms, you have very, very few women. So in some ways, there's nothing new here. There's nothing new. The onward march of women, having gaining and using and getting comfortable with more and more opportunity and power in established institutions goes on. There's nothing brand new about that in the large sweep of history. Frederick Douglass would recognize it well, because he actually spent the last part of his life being very, very active for women's suffrage. On the other hand, high tech is an industry, particularly the term Silicon Valley, that inspires, I think, more awe than consternation or more awe than criticism. And what the trial did in many, many ways, and probably more powerfully out of the media in the grapevine in Northern California and in circles that take their cues from Northern California, and those are many, was to say, look, it's still such an old boys network. And the reason that happened is two. One, the evidence that came out in the trial, important to note, dear listeners, that some of the most important or significant evidence for the jury in voting that she should not be awarded damages was their estimation of her performance and the performance review that Ellen Pao had at Kleiner Perkins, and so there was evidence of that form, but there was also all this evidence that was brought forward about how she was treated and what she experienced there, including, I'll never forget this, I believe it was a junior partner who said she should have been flattered that a colleague showed up in only his bathrobe at one of her hotel rooms. And this is just one tiny, tiny piece. But this was said in all seriousness. So again, it's not useful to kind of emotionally vent about this. It's more to note it as a sociologist, as Emile Durkheim would, and say, what does this say about the surrounding culture? An unconscious sense of behavior. A lot. And so a lot of the grapevine, right? A lot of what goes for the modus operandi in places like Kleiner Perkins was revealed in full glory, in full infamy here. And that's very important.
One of the things we occasionally, Marjorie and I, have debates about the quality of the jury system in this country. Mm-hmm. And I know it's unpatriotic to be like me and say I don't have full faith in the jury. In this case, there were four counts in the civil trial.
Yeah.
And you needed 9 out of 12 people to vote a particular way. The jury came in and said they had found for the defendant, the company, in all four cases. And when the judge polled the jury, the judge found out on the fourth case they'd counted wrong. They only had eight votes instead of nine, and they had to go back. That's the first part of this, but which has nothing to do with the substance. What does, if people are saying this sounds somewhat familiar and it's not from the news, it's from the show, this is the case last week or 2 weeks ago before you went on vacation, where we discussed that one solution that this Kleiner Perkins firm was to give Alan Powell training in how to interrupt in meetings.
Hold on.
What's that?
I really wasn't on vacation. I went to school to learn how to interrupt as well as Jim.
I know, she did, right. So essentially what they decided...
So I'm back, full throttle, but I haven't really been meeting the success I thought I would.
So what they were doing is they're coaching her to improve her speaking skills, as the Times says, to participate in the firm's interrupt-driven environment. So did she lose because she was incompetent?
So I think there were real questions about how competent she was relative to her peers by the jury. And we will never know with exactitude how exactly they perceived her performance. And so the reason that she didn't get promoted was not primarily because of sexism or some kind of consistent discrimination, but because she wasn't good enough. That's what the jury says, and a couple of it's interesting to read if you do some hunting and pecking here around the story. There are different people in Silicon Valley, including some women who've come forward and said, "Yeah, I think there probably are some questions about whether her performance was as good as some of her peers or was up to snuff." But that doesn't in any way they're also saying it's a victory because it doesn't in any way detract from or minimize the fact that the culture that she existed in was a culture in which primarily men interact with other men and don't necessarily, you know, have a lot of mindfulness about how they're treating people who aren't men, treating women. And there's any woman that's worked in an all-male institution or an institution that had a lot more men than women can empathize with or relate to just about every anecdote and every piece of non-performance evidence that we have access to around this trial. So that's just very interesting. And, you know, it says a lot about lots and lots and lots of progress has been made, and there is still some way to go because, as Mark said, you know, the infrastructure has a lot to do with conditioning the superstructure. This is very embedded behavior in the case of a lot of these people.
Well, it also talked about the relationships between the men and the women were kind of the other, you know. Yeah. There's this great paragraph here that talks about these female venture capitalists' financial performance is about 15% lower than that of their male colleagues. So you read this. This was done by one of your colleagues at Harvard Business School. Yeah. You read that. You think, wow, maybe they're not performing. But the entire difference in performance, the study found, is that women do not benefit from their male colleagues while men help one another. When there are several female investors at a firm, women do benefit from their female colleagues' contributions. So you saw whether the networks were forming between the men and excluding the women, and then when the women could form their own networks, they were helping each
other
out.
Absolutely, because I can tell you, as someone who's been on a number of boards and done a lot of work with entrepreneurs, this work is extraordinarily collaborative. The work of figuring out how to invest in companies, what not to invest in, which not to invest in, which to invest in, once you've invested in, how to get them up out of the ether and down onto the ground, and how to get the organization built. It's all about collaboration. You don't do it in a little room, right, waiting for the oracle to visit you. So it's Paul Gompers, my colleague at HBO. Yes, you did the study, and that makes complete sense.
It does.
Right. And yet at the same time, you can take a deep yoga breath, separate yourself from this and say, okay, it's a bunch of men who've been working with a lot of other men. They go on their own fishing and golf trips and things. They don't necessarily include women. It's never included women. And so now there are women in their mix, and, you know, ooh, what do we do? And you can imagine that it's not necessarily malicious. It's not necessarily full of any kind of malfeasance. It is... A kind of strangeness that is I use those terms with thought. Right? There's a strangeness to this that when you have networks of people that are remarkably similar, there can be something. As one of my students said in the second day of class, when we were talking about Alexander Hamilton, his life had a lot to do with stark otherness, in which women, you know, a few women in an all boys club or an institution that's heavily populated by men look starkly other.
Yeah.
You know, though, when you mentioned being excluded from things, my favorite example of that I've read about this firm, I'm sure you both read this thing where a partner did not want women invited to some dinner with Al Gore
because
women would, quote, kill the buzz, which I think speaks to a certain maliciousness that you say may not be there.
Wait, so let me
ask if I can. Is Alan Powell sort of the Anita Hill of this thing? Anita Hill, as we know, didn't win her effort. Clarence Thomas, who doesn't speak much, is on the court until he decides not to be on the court anymore. But I think I think Marjorie, you're amongst those who think she changed everything.
I think Anita Hill is my heroine for my work life pre Anita Hill and post Anita Hill. And I told Jim I actually got to cover the hearings. That was one of the big thrills of my it was great. It was great. It was so crowded to sit there. But I think you can relate to this too, Nancy. The world changed in the workplace only because corporations became very nervous about being sued by women. So suddenly they had all these rules.
So does Ellen Powell change things?
I'm not sure that she becomes the analog of Anita Hill. I think she does change things. But see, part of I remember the hearings very clearly. I just actually started at the Harvard Business School. It was the first semester I was teaching. She was so clearly so smart and so on it.
Who, Anita Hill?
Anita Hill.
Oh, yeah.
And so well-spoken. So what I have read about the testimony of Ellen Powell was that actually she wasn't so trenchant and insightful and credible on the witness stand. So that matters. That matters. But here's the way in which I think she does, you know, she does fulfill some of what you're asking about when you talk about Anita Hill. You know, there's no question now, and it's already begun, that different high-tech firms, both on the financing side and on the product or service side, are getting involved in thinking about how to bring women, not only more women into the firm, but also how once they're there, how to make it a place where they can succeed. Because Ellen was brought in, but there's good reason to think that the conditions weren't necessarily all that they could have been, shall we put it very gently, to make her succeed. And, you know, both a number of firms have started to think about this. And then you step back one more step. I remember after the financial crash doing a short radio segment about whether women had dominated trading desks, right, in credit default swaps or collateralized debt obligations, the story would have been exactly the same, because women turned out to be a very different kind of traders than men. You now have the same kind of question here, which is, what are venture capital, private equity, and high-tech firms losing? Think about a company like Facebook, where a huge amount of their audience is women. What are you losing? What's the opportunity cost of not having more women involved in the creativity, innovation, and development of your firm? It's just a really clear business issue that this doesn't make good business sense, no matter how you look at it, keeping it all monolithic and heavily male.
Nancy Kane, let me just interrupt here for one second. What are you laughing at?
I'm
over
laughing.
There?
No, I'm not. You're missing it. It's Marjorie, whose memory is not as good as it probably should be, when you mentioned credit default swaps.
I remember
on our old radio station in the middle of the crisis, Marjorie and I it may have been an hour on the radio trying to explain to listeners something that we didn't understand at all but felt an obligation. We tried to explain credit default swaps. I don't think we succeeded in that particular enterprise. You know, you mentioned the hearings. One thing that bears noting in light of the fact that it was the day after the Edward M. Kennedy Institute dedication yesterday.
Yep.
I may get this slightly wrong, but since you were there and you paid attention, Nancy, and Marjorie was there, Ted Kennedy was basically silenced. He was on the Judiciary Committee but couldn't say anything in that hearing. Why? Because it was immediately after, was it Palm Beach or whatever.
He did say something, though, toward the end.
At the end, towards the end, correct.
When Clarence Thomas talked about this being a high-tech lynching, Ted Kennedy got on his high horse and said, please, you know, don't even go there.
But until then, he was silent, was he not?
He was still silent. But you know what I love about this whole thing is that, you know, a lot of times when you hear about the pay differential between men and women, I mean, one of the facts is a lot of women, when they have kids, decide that they no longer want to work 90 hours a week. And I love, because that's been the whole deal that you hear about Silicon Valley, where everybody shows up with their dogs and their jeans, and they sleep on cots, or they have their daycare centers at the Google Place, and they have their barbershops there, so you can essentially live there. And if a lot of women are not able to work 80 hours a week, especially when their children are small, so that this, I like the idea that they're getting shaken up a little bit out there, because you're not going, it allows them to have a place in an atmosphere that they wouldn't have otherwise. Because there has to be some, you know, a lot of these stories talk about that everything's very loosey-goosey in a lot of the Silicon Valley world, and that women do better in these corporations that have more rules and more process.
And more process, right.
Because a lot of them do have those work-family balance concerns, which, I mean, I hate to be so sexist about it, but for the most part, not as many men have those same concerns.
No, although I have to say, I just taught a case on Oprah Winfrey to my HBS students, and I was really impressed with, I taught this case first in 2005, actually Oprah showed up for class, one of the day is never to be forgotten.
For your class?
It was a surprise. Yeah.
Oh, you're kidding.
Did you know she was coming?
No, I didn't know. In fact, she had specifically said, I'm in New York for a very important philanthropic commitment. And then she showed up with her executive producer, her CFO, with the president of Harpo Productions, Franklin, her hairstylist, and her makeup people. It was extraordinary.
In
my class. All of Harvard Business School, of course, poured in once they got on their cell phones and the students told them that she was there. She was extraordinary.
So were you able to keep talking?
Oh, yeah. I taught the case for an hour, and then I gave her half an hour in each class. I taught the same class. I teach the same class back to back, dear listeners. And then she spoke.
She was amazing.
And
that's great.
But in any event, I just literally walked out of the classroom, and it was so interesting to compare this class to, and the men in the class speaking about her, to a class 10 years ago. I mean, the world really is changing, right? And you really do have a whole generation. These are men, you know, average age 27, right? With a whole new perspective on what it means to have a family and have a two career family and have kids. And so the world really is changing. But as you know, what I think Frederick Douglass said, those who want real change without agitation want, you know, they want rain without thunder. They want crops without rain and thunder. And so none of this change comes easily, right? It's not offered up. It's demanded and then slowly, sometimes grudgingly ceded. And part of what's going on here is another thunderbolt is clapping across the sky in the Douglass sense here around this trial and around the reverb, including firms that will enact better hiring and better mentoring processes. Both established firms like Kleiner Perkins, it's been around a long time. It should, in a sense, have the kind of big company practices you're talking about.
Which is weird. It did happen at that firm.
It is weird. And some of the anecdotes are ones you wouldn't expect from a blue, from a white shoe firm, so to speak. But part of what we're seeing is another thunderbolt, right, around change here and the reverb, some of which will be defensive. Companies in Silicon Valley will now enact different practices, different polls, different surveys, and then new policies, partly so they don't get sued. But it will still be progress. And again, I say to you as someone who teaches young people that they are already in a very different place.
No,
about
you are
this
right.
Stuff.
You are right. And that's really encouraging.
It is encouraging. It's exciting and it's encouraging. And I think it is part of the future. But again, there's nothing – there's still great work to be done here. A good friend of mine who was a former student of mine who now runs a diabetes research firm called Close Concerns, Kelly Close, was telling me that this is all anybody is talking about.
Really?
Right. You know, mothers at private schools, the people she knows in the medical world, everyone – Silicon Valley is rippling, roiling in the aftermath.
The word
of this.
Roiling.
Roiling. And that's actually a good thing. They should be roiling. And we should be talking about this. And you know, Ellen Pao is, I believe, interim CEO at Reddit.
Reddit, yeah, she is.
And so you wonder what her next move will be, because she's now, to your point, Jim, she's now a public figure.
So are there firms that trumpet – first of all, are there firms that don't have this – in that world, in Silicon Valley, that have a record of treating women almost the same as they treat men? And two, isn't that a selling point? I mean, if all things
Absolutely.
Are relatively equal, it seems to me if someone
Absolutely.
Has a better record than this operation, isn't that – aren't you more likely to get business when you're competing with somebody and you're on
Absolutely.
A relatively equal plane?
Business,
so who are the good guys, so to speak?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I'm trying to think of who – I'm not sure I'm the best person qualified to answer that around mm-hmm. Silicon Valley. I mean, I can tell you about traditional large firms here on this that are based on this side of the country where I think they've made this a point not only – for good business, not only for customers, but to attract the best talent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one of the most famous examples is Deloitte & Touche, which is a consulting firm that's very much diversified their offerings over the last 15 years. They decided about 10 years ago, we're going to be the employer of choice for all kinds of bright women. Right, who are going to opt in and opt out and have part time and do job sharing, and we're going to pilot every single smart experiment we can think of, and we're going to watch what happens to our talent and our business. And they unequivocally rate it a huge success. And they
really?
Bet real money. They've bet real money, and they've bet great other resources on this, and it has been a big win for the company.
So, I'm curious.
It was a very explicit move around your point. This will make us better.
So I'm curious what Deloitte does about women who have babies. Do they give them a reasonable time at home?
I don't know the specifics anymore. I used to know, but it's changed. But I believe they have what by comparison would be a very generous family family leave policy. We talked about that a few months ago. Family leave. But what's really interesting is how they work with women that want to come back in the workforce after they've had children and been out.
Yeah.
And how they want to do job sharing, what kind of flexibility, and where you can work, and all those kind of deal breaking issues that derail a lot of different kinds of what we call more progressive work-family policies that are mostly affecting women. But I'm telling you, look, judging from this generation of men that I'm teaching, they're going to affect men in 10 years.
You know, but I don't want to end on a down note, but let's anyway. you're saying we're making progress. We talked a couple of minutes, weeks ago, about that study. What's it called? The Boston Club, about the zero zeros, where 22 of the top 100 firms in Massachusetts don't have one woman on the board nor one woman in the executive suite. One out of five are zero zeros. I mean, even if you don't believe in diversity, it would seem to me in 2015, you'd know that you can't do business without it. You have 15 seconds.
Okay, Catherine Graham took over the post in 1963 after her husband, Phil Graham, shot himself. She was the only woman in charge of a Fortune 500 company. Progress has happened.
You win.
Progress has absolutely happened.
I give up.
Happened.
I surrender.
And I'm embarrassed. I misplaced my paper with it. James E. Robeson.
Chair of Business Administration.
Okay, I'm sorry about that, Nancy Kane. Nancy Kane is with us every week from the Harvard Business School on Tuesday. Nancy Kane, thank you for being here again today, and thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. We've got Brian McGroy from the Boston Globe.
We have Juliet Kayyem, Art Kaplan as well. And tonight, you know who's on Greater Boston with
me? I do. I am.
That'd be you.
What else you got going?
Marjorie Egan, Jim Pizer, the Secretary of Education, Noah Feldman from Harvard Law School, a whole host, Reverend Jeffrey Brown, a whole host of people. We'll see you tomorrow, and I'll see you tonight at 7. Bye.
Bye.